Welcome to episode 108 of Primary Care Update. I'm Mark A. Bell, a family physician and professor at the University of Georgia and editor-in-chief of Essential Evidence Plus.
I'm Kate Rowland, family physician and associate professor at Rush University.
Hi, I'm Henry Barry, a family physician and one of the co-founders of InfoPoems. I've got a couple of noteworthy anniversaries, if you will, for those baby boomers especially. Last week, July 30th, 2022, was George Jetson's proverbial birthday. So if you grew up watching the Jetsons, happy birthday, George. And then today is Tony Bennett's birthday. He's 96, a multi-generational star. I can remember my grandparents listening to his recordings. And now through his partnership with Lady Gaga, a whole new set of generations have enjoyed his ability to sing.
Thanks, Henry. Yeah, the Lady Gaga concert was great. On this podcast, we highlight poems, patient-oriented evidence that matters. If you want to get one a day in your email, plus a great primary care reference, over 800 chapters, check out EssentialEvidencePlus.com. The opinions expressed on Primary Care Update are those of the commentators, and this podcast doesn't represent medical advice or the endorsement of any product. You can get CME credit by going to IFP.com, clicking on their education webpage, and finding our podcast. This week, LDL reduction, the cost-effectiveness of newer Alzheimer's drugs, and surgery for musculoskeletal problems. Kate, get us started, please.
You bet. So I have today a meta-analysis of randomized controlled trials. It included 21 studies, about 130,000 patients altogether, to answer the question of what exactly is the impact of low-density lipoprotein cholesterol reduction, LDL reduction, on the individual risks of myocardial infarction, MI, stroke, and overall mortality. The short answer is it works, but not to the magnitude that we probably think when we prescribe these meds. So the studies included cover the years of 1987 through just last year, 2021. And overall, the risks of bias in the included studies were judged as low. And again, the authors focused only on those patient-oriented outcomes. So they were not looking so much at does it lower cholesterol or not. They included both primary and secondary prevention studies. So as compared with placebo, statin treatment produced a 0.08% overall absolute risk reduction in the likelihood of death due to any cause during the course of the study, which was typically between 3 and 8 years. So remember, this was a meta-analysis. Different studies followed patients for different amounts of time. The likelihood of a heart attack decreased by 1.3% in 18 of the studies that included that as an outcome, and stroke was decreased by 0.4%. So one interesting takeaway, there was an inconsistent relationship in the studies between the degree of LDL lowering and the prevention of the outcome that they were studying. So this lack of a clear, you know, dose response is interesting, although it's not completely unknown. If you've been around in practicing medicine for more than a hot minute, you know that the recommendation for treating to LDL targets versus just treating with statins have kind of gone around the block. We've done it and then we've not done it. And now we're kind of just coming back to doing it again. There was some statistical heterogeneity among the studies, which likely means that there were differences among the study populations. The authors cautioned against calculating numbers needed to treat, but the poem author recklessly did it anyways. It was 88 to 250 people needed to treat for one additional person to be alive at the end of that 3 to 6 year time span. The authors don't spend enough time discussing, in my opinion, the biggest reason people take statins, which is that it's incredibly rewarding to see the numbers getting better. It feels very sort of active. But 99 people in 100 think that they have had their heart attack prevented by taking the statin. They feel like their life has been saved and they will never know different because they are alive and well, even though we have just these very tiny, tiny changes. Henry, what do you think?
Well, if I remember correctly, this might have been the basis of a quiz not a couple of episodes ago, and this gives us a chance to have a more full discussion about the issue. As you point out, the guidelines have kind of ping-ponged around a little bit, and in general, regardless of whether you treat to target or you treat to dose, the U.S. guidelines have generally been much more aggressive than Canadian and European guidelines. And I remember a number of years ago, I believe Manuel was the author, actually looked at efficiency of various guidelines and targets. And lo and behold, the US guidelines were the most aggressive, but the least efficient of all of the various ones that are out there.
It's very on brand for us.
And very expensive in the ability to pursue these more aggressive guidelines. This ping-ponging between whether you use a drug dose target versus an LDL target is really fascinating because, to my knowledge, there's only been a single study that has actually looked at LDL targets, and that wasn't all that great. All of the rest are really an extrapolation. We put people on doses. If you're at a medium or moderate risk, we'll put you on a medium or low dose statin. If you're at high risk, we put you on a high risk, on a high dose statin. And then, oh, by the way, these are the average LDLs that were achieved. And that's not the same as treating to a specific target. So this is a great example of one of the potential fallacies in extrapolating beyond what the research actually shows. And I think among cardiologists, there are those who believe in the lipid theory of atherogenesis and those that believe that there's some other process, probably inflammation. And the nice thing about statins is that they probably affect both, which gives both camps the ability to argue back. They're kind of like Republicans and Democrats. I think I made this comment before. They all just see the world very differently. So I'm very comfortable in making a recommendation that you treat to a drug target and not go chasing LDL levels, which is what the American Heart Association, American College of Cardiology guideline from a couple of years ago espoused. Mark, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there was a lot of heterogeneity, and I think that probably is because it sounds like they combined primary and secondary prevention, and we know that the absolute magnitude of benefit, the relative benefit is pretty similar between primary and secondary prevention, but because you have such a higher baseline risk of an event with secondary prevention, folks who've already had a heart attack, you get a much higher absolute gain in those folks and a smaller one. I think it's still real. I think it's still there. I think many people would consider it clinically relevant in primary prevention, but it's going to be smaller. And I think that's where that heterogeneity comes from. So good stuff. I'll keep taking my atorvastatin, free ad for atorvastatin right now, for now. So I got the quiz. According to 2019 IDSA guidelines, which of the following is a recommended antibiotic for community-acquired pneumonia in outpatients without significant comorbidities and no risk factors for MRSA? A, amoxicillin clavulanate or Augmentin. B, a respiratory fluoroquinolone like levofloxacin, C, doxycycline, D, a macrolide plus a beta-lactam drug. Stay tuned. Henry, let's talk about aducanumab and donanemab again.
Again. So this poem asks whether or not these newer agents, these monoclonal antibodies against amyloid, are cost-effective. This was done by Ross in JAMA Neurology in May. So I mentioned Tony Bennett earlier because in addition to that concert, there have been some documentaries showing his own struggles with Alzheimer's. And the remarkable thing is that while his cognitive function is impaired, his ability to sing and remember lyrics has generally not been as effective. And it just shows the complexities of this disease. I also included this because we haven't really done many cost effectiveness analyses. And just as an aside, John, Mark, and I, our very first collaborative effort was a cost utility analysis back in the 90s. And it was great fun to do. And these are kind of fun projects for those who are statistically inclined. So the basis for a cost utility analysis or a cost effectiveness analysis is that you begin with sort of a tree of treatment options and various branch points for various outcomes. And what you build into the tree is a set of probabilities of the various outcomes and the weighting of the outcome itself. And with a cost effectiveness analysis, or in this case, a cost utility analysis, they use something called the quality adjusted life year, which is to try to assign a numeric value on a common thread for each of these various outcomes. And we can have much longer conversation over adult beverages if you'd like about this, but not today. So they did a decision analysis that included various estimates of harms and benefits as well as their associated costs. And because of some of the noise and the imprecision in all of this, they did something called a sensitivity analysis where they vary the values to try to see how robust all of this stuff is. Now, one of the problems that they ran into is that there were scores that were reported in the various studies that they then tried to convert into some quality adjusted life year. And that conversion, they say, is messy. And what they decided to do was to actually put a very optimistic value into these outcomes. Okay. And then they used $150,000 per quality adjusted life year, sort of their threshold for determining cost effectiveness, which is a much larger number than what we normally would see. Okay, so keep in mind, they've done optimistic kinds of outcomes to try to make it look like this might be cost effective. They used a much higher value than usual. And what did they find? Well, it turns out that they really didn't find that this stuff was cost effective at all. Now, keep in mind, we've done some studies. We just reviewed one that showed that these really are not effective in improving outcomes. And when you put a zero in the denominator, the cost becomes infinite. And so I think this is consistent with the studies that Mark and I have reviewed recently. Mark, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I was kind of surprised that someone did the study, since there's, you do have to have some effectiveness to do a cost effectiveness analysis. But I wasn't as upset or concerned, I should say. I don't get upset about these things. I get concerned about the $150,000 cutoff per quali as their threshold for what's cost effective. The $50,000 was the classic number used, but that's dated back to the 1990s or earlier. And so, you know, we've had a little inflation since then. And so I think especially the last year. And so, you know, using 100 or 150,000, 100 has become much more common. This is the first time I've seen 150,000, but I think you can make an argument for it. Generally, it's some sort of a multiple of what the average or the median U.S. wage is how that gets determined. So this would be about three times the median U.S. Income. So in any case, you know, certainly another vote against EDUCANUMED. Kate?
I don't think I have anything to add here. It doesn't work and it's very expensive.
But it does cause side effects.
Well,
I'm really good at that. It's really good at causing brain swelling.
I could cause you side effects for a lot less money.
Yeah, true, true. I'll give you a baseball bat. Yeah, I know you're from Chicago.
Yeah. Okay. So just to point out, the EDUCANUMED or Aduhelm was the one that cause all sorts of controversy with the FDA and its approval process. Donanemab goes through for the name Al's Forum, has yet to be FDA approved.
Okay. Thank you, guys. I'm going to talk a little about shifting gears, and we promise not to talk about Aduhelm for a few months, hopefully. The title is Only Some Musculoskeletal Conditions Benefit from Surgery, which is, I think we knew that. This is in the Journal of Orthopedic Sports Physical Therapy 2022. And the question was, compared with non-surgical interventions, do surgical approaches to common musculoskeletal problems offer a benefit? And this was a really good meta-analysis. They searched a bunch of databases, PubMed, Cochrane, three others, identified 100 randomized trials with over 12,000 patients comparing surgical with non-surgical treatment of 28 different conditions at 9 different body sites, you know, back, neck, knee, shoulder, etc. 30 trials were considered to be at high risk of bias, but that means 70 were not. Most of the risk of bias was because they weren't masking either the participants, which often is not possible, the intervention providers, the surgeons doing the surgery or not doing it, and the outcome assessors. You know, that's the outcome assessors you should be able to mask, so that's on them. The studies evaluated the effect of surgery on pain, function, and quality of life, and they also looked at the likelihood of serious adverse effects. They did primarily look at they looked at both statistically and clinical significance of the benefit, which is good. And they really focus on that clinical significance. Was there at least a moderate or higher benefit in the outcomes they're looking at? So what did they define? The severe adverse events were those that could significantly compromise the outcome, require hospitalization, prolonged hospital care, life-threatening, et cetera. So clinically relevant benefit on pain and or function and or quality of life was seen with surgery for the following conditions: cervical disc herniation and radiculopathy, chronic low back pain, SI joint pain, and lumbar spinal stenosis. Less risk of a severe adverse event, no effect on pain necessarily, but less risk of a severe adverse event, shoulder dislocation, knee or patellar dislocation, and knee or anterior cruciate ligament tear. So those were things where the pain wasn't any better, but there were less recurrences, presumably, particularly with these dislocations. Finally, no clinically relevant benefit was seen for pain, functioning, or quality of life for meniscal tears of the knee, impingement syndrome in the hip, Achilles tendon rupture, carpal tunnel syndrome, lumbar disc herniation, lumbar spondylolisthesis, rotator cuff tear, or shoulder impingement and pain. So physical therapists. Now, there may have been an implicit bias here in that this was in the Journal of Orthopedic Sports Physical Therapy. So they may have had a bit of a bias against surgery and in favor of giving them a chance to help the patient before going to surgery. But I think for a lot of these conditions, there probably are selected patients that do better, but let's try physical therapy first for these folks and give that a good try before we let the surgeons sharpen their blades. Kate?
Yeah, I find this whole thing very troubling. So the problem is that, first of all, it's a meta-analysis. So, you know, maybe there was, as you said, some bias looking for studies where, you know, they were more likely to benefit from physical therapy. But it's a meta-analysis. So they had 100 randomized controlled trials. They'd have to find 100 of them and to find, you know, they'd have to systematically be biasing themselves, which I wouldn't rule out, but maybe a little bit less likely. Second, this is a pattern that we see over and over and over again in the orthopedic literature. I think we do have to start taking a little bit more seriously the idea that a lot of what we do in operative orthopedics for, again, these sort of chronic conditions is probably low value care. And part of it, we were talking about sort of cost benefit ratios, it's very expensive. And if it doesn't work and it's very expensive, that it really is time to start taking that more seriously, in part so that it's also potentially, if we say, oh, surgery for this, and it doesn't work, it's potentially standing in the way of exploring more effective treatments for these things that really do affect a lot of people. I find the whole thing troubling, and I don't know why we keep talking about them, and we're really not taking, you know, particularly active steps sort of at the systemic level, to stop doing these things that really don't help. Henry?
So there's lots to unpack here. And Kate, you covered a couple of the things that I was planning on talking about. Certainly, this is consistent with other studies. We did an Australian meta-analysis in one of our courses a couple of years ago, where they weren't quite as ambitious. They just took the top 20 procedures in Australia and did systematic reviews to see how effective those were just for pain. Okay. And basically found that the quality of the studies were poor and that generally were not effective. The notion of surgery versus sham surgery. When that has been done, generally sham surgery has been found to be as good as the real surgery. So we can't let people off the hook. Now there's a limit, right? It's, you could imagine that if you're talking about joint replacement surgery, which I assume was not included in any of these studies, it would be very hard to do a sham joint replacement surgery, right? So, you know, I think that if I were to look at all of this, the way it plays out is that if you're dealing with surgery for something that, so for my first knee jerk is surgery is probably not likely to be of much help for most individuals for pain primarily. For function, it looked like it was kind of messy because they blended pain and function in some of these outcomes. So I'd love to see the individual outcomes teased out a little bit. But if I were to think about how I might cluster this, if it deals with appendicular joints, it's probably not going to be very effective compared with axial. Okay, so if we're dealing with spinal stuff, there may be something there, but probably not for the other joints.
Henry, thank you. I just learned a new word. I thought those were in the appendix.
Oh,
perpendicular, I'd heard of. Hey, last comment on that. There have been actually studies of knee replacement comparing immediate surgery to weightlifting and showed a large benefit. So, just for our listeners. Okay, time to answer the quiz and get you guys back to work. According to 2019 IDSA guidelines, which of the following is a recommended antibiotic for community-acquired pneumonia in outpatients without significant comorbidities and no risk factors for MRSA? Amoxiclav, fluoroquinolone, doxycycline, or a macrolide plus a beta-lactam. So for community-acquired pneumonia in outpatients, amoxiclav is not a recommended antibiotic at all. A respiratory fluoroquinolone or the combination of a macrolide plus a beta-lactam are recommended, but for outpatients with comorbidities. For outpatients without comorbidities, amoxicillin, doxycycline, or a macrolide alone are recommended. Macrolides are only recommended when their community-wide resistance is less than about 25%. So the correct answer is C, doxycycline. Thanks, everybody, for listening. If you want to find some CME credit, go to IAFP.com and click on their online education webpage. They are accredited by the ACCME to give CME credit. You get a half an AMA Category 1 credit for completing a brief survey about the podcast. The IFP adheres to the conflicts of interest policies that they should. You can read their complete disclosure at their website. Hope you all enjoyed today's discussion. Please tell your friends about Primary Care Update. We'll talk to you soon with more Primary Care Updates.